FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's August 21st, 2018. Well, been a while since you've heard from our guest today, but hey, gone but not forgotten. But as always, write us an email, be a part of the show, kl@kerrylutz.com. Hey, particularly if you've got any guest suggestions, we're always looking for new people to give you new views, to give you new insights, and maybe, who knows, we'll actually find out somebody who knows what the heck is really going on. So send us those emails. And now Danielle Park is with us. It's been a month, Danielle. Welcome back from your world travels.
Thank you, Kerry. Very busy month for you, too. Happy congratulations on your new grandchild.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's been an exciting month. But hey, it's always exciting watching the markets. And your article, The Sound of Inevitability, Peak Debt and Peak Prices, why is it they go hand in hand? At least that's what I'd like to know. And well, hey, you wrote the article. Tell us what's in it here.
So basically, that direct connection between the infusion of credit and the massive leap in credit in the past decade, in particular since the Great Recession, and how that translated into leaping asset prices and things that were financed. So, for example, housing, rents in many cities is now, you know, there's lots of articles. We're back to that whole period where you're reading about people in California, even in the tech industry, which is paid more than most, living in their cars and in vans and, you know, commuting 3 and 4 hours a day because they can't find anywhere that's affordable to live in anywhere within shooting range of their employment. So there's that aspect of it. And that also translates into things like the three times the rate of inflation leap in education costs, both in student housing and in tuition and in books over the past, decade. Because again, things that can be financed have been the benefactors of these price gains, but the whole thing comes full circle when you realize that those things are unaffordable for the masses, and particularly for the younger masses, who the older folks who may have ridden these price inflation, you know, in their things like real estate, and they're happy to have the gains. The problem is when they go to cash out, they're looking for someone typically younger for them to take that off their hands. And therein lies the rub. So, you know, it's been this double-edged sword of price inflation in some assets and services. But then that always comes full circle because now those things are not affordable at those prices. And when you want to raise cash or, you know, find a buyer for your service or your asset, that's where the problem comes in. And that's where prices ultimately find the weight of gravity because they have to have a bid in order to have a transaction.
Yeah, and all that's understandable. And yet we had 4% growth, GDP growth. Maybe it's a little bit lower because inflation's a little higher. Who knows? Assume they're calculating it the way they're always supposed to. Is that just the sign of a peak, or can this thing go on even further, Danielle?
Well, it is sort of the peak growth you've had this cycle. And, you know, with the tax package that went through and all the hyperbole and hope about, you know, that being hugely stimulative, it's kind of surprising, you know, that with record low interest rates and still massive balance sheet swell in the central bank, it's kind of amazing that it's taken A, this long to get 4%, and B, that it wasn't higher. But having said all that, I'm incredibly skeptical of GDP prints in real time because they typically are always, massive revisions after the fact. And that goes on for months and years, Kerry, as you well know. We'll be looking back at this particular period a few years from now, and they'll still be revising the QE numbers on that. So I think it's more likely that we're seeing, you know, certainly peak in terms of record low unemployment. We're seeing capacity output peak kind of in this cycle, GDP growth peak of late. But it's more a question of what happens next. You know, whenever you're talking about the longest bull market in history, which congratulations, we have as of today, tying the all-time longest run from the 1990s. As of tomorrow, will be officially the longest bull market in history, second largest in terms of price appreciation, but largest in terms of valuation increase in things like, price to sales, for example. We're at 2.2 times the S&P 500 companies' price to their actual revenue, which is worse than the very top cycle, which was peaked in 2000. So really, whenever I hear about this is as good as it's been, this is the peak, the question is always, okay, well, what comes next? And I think that's where it gets much more complicated, because typically when things can't get any better, they only get worse. And that's where this whole mean reversion process is likely to begin. And we know it's way overdue. It took until 2013 for people to recover the peak, or for markets to recover their peak from 2007. And in the last 5 years, it's really returned everything that's been gained in the last decade came in the last 5 years, and particularly in the last three. So you really have to wonder where we're headed next. And I think that's the part where it's so much a human nature. You know, I was writing about the Bitcoin folks who have been all wiped out, and they were, making the comment that they just got, really frenzied into the fear of missing out and buying
dopamine. Dopamine transmitters. It's all about the dopamine.
That's right. Well, so people are now saying, aha, look at the Bitcoin. People lost their shirts, and cryptocurrency is, in a huge drop and down 70%. But that's actually typical, right? When you get a frenzied peak with a rapid gain full of great speculation and lots of leverage, the mean reversion after that is very often around 70%. We've seen that repeated.
80-90% sometimes.
Sometimes. If you're talking about Fibonacci retracement stuff, it's like very classically in financial cycles for as long as we can trace them. So that's why, again, back to this longest bull market in history, begs the question, what will this mean reversion look like? And historically, when we've had these secular boom phases in valuation, which ultimately leads to a big mean reversion, you get things like a 70% correction. And that would take the Dow, for example, back to, 7,000 range. Mm-hmm. And that would mean that people have been riding the wave, but ultimately have made zero net returns since the late 90s, if that's the case. Because, the 2000 peak for the Dow was in and around just 11,000, sort of. And it's retested that support now in 2003, 2003, and in 2007, 2009. So, and people can't imagine that that's possible, Carrie. They think, this is impossible, and yet this is the common recurring pattern.
Yeah, and patterns are somewhat predictable, right? We see it over and over and over again. And really, should anybody be surprised?
Well, but they are, and they're always taken off guard. And I get it. Listen, I get it. It takes a lot. An interesting study I was reading recently was talking about how you have to take more energy to be positive. That the other parameters are sort of, fear, anger. Those are more commonly negative emotions. And most of the human psyche can spend a lot of its time just there, kind of as the path of least resistance. And to be truly positive about things takes more energy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that made sense to me, except when it came to the area of finance, because in the area of finance and money, it seems to me that the normal resting place, because the bias of the industry is to sell us on ideas of hope and optimism and to sell us products, the bias of the industry is to always look on the upside, the positive. But there's almost no time or attention given to the opposite of that, which is, where markets spend, a lot of their time. Historically, in other words, the returns are dictated much more by what happens on the downside than what happens in the upcycle. And yet all the energy is focused on just proclaiming the up cycle and hoping like hell the down cycle doesn't come. But of course, that's not a practical approach because it's just part of it. It's, you know, when as I say, when you can't add more credit because people's wages haven't increased, because revenues haven't gone up, as I said, you know, total revenue growth since 2009 for the S&P companies, which are the strongest, most profitable companies in the world, their total revenue growth has been 30% in the last 9 years relative to a 300% jump in their earnings. And if you look at why that earnings has been able to jump 300%, it is things like, short-termism, focus on cutting costs, on not making longer-term investment, which will ultimately produce greater innovation and success in the future. It's been all about financial gimmick, short-term, how to get the price of the share up, buybacks, things that ultimately are destructive of long-term strength and stability have been the things that have been able to goose earnings in the short run. But again, earnings are also an incredibly reliably mean reverting series. And so when you've got peak earnings, record earnings at a record multiple, you know, the whatever one you want to use, there's so many of them. The Case-Shiller PE index 10-year smoothed is almost 33 today. You know, that's the second highest ever in history relative to above the peak of 29 and just under the peak of 2000. So we've got peak earnings for all the artificial factors, setting aside of mark-to-market accounting, QE, all that stuff. Was great in the short run, but with revenues not increasing at a tenth of the pace that the reported profits increased, that really connects back to nominal GDP and to wage growth in the actual economy. And those things are where, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of what consumption people can sustain over time, what borrowing they can continue to do. You know, they can't keep adding debt unless they get an increase in cash flows. And if they're not getting that increase in cash flows, then you're not going to be able to keep adding to the debt cycle. And that's why ultimately it always contracts.
Yeah, eventually that's inevitable. But this one's been going on for so long, Danielle. It just shows you how much money they pumped
into
amazing. The economy.
It really is.
To keep it going this long. It's amazing.
It is incredible. And Ben Bernanke, you know, his maniacal plan was, I have to give him that. It was remarkably effective in boosting asset prices. And, you know, but the difficulty in this is that although that was their short-term plan, boost asset prices, bail out the banks, try and reset the system so it doesn't all go bankrupt. That was his original thought. And rolled that out. But the sort of, what do you call it, the naive part of his thesis, which was probably because he didn't want to think about that negative effect, was that once you've got those prices all back up, you know, if you don't have the economic growth, if it doesn't come on stream the way that you have been hoping, then you're going to have a funding crisis again, because now you've got shrinking cash flows in the face of higher debt payments, rising interest rates. You know, a ton of money in the world has been borrowed in U.S. dollars, Carrie. They've been raising rates. That means we're having an emerging market cash crunch already.
Meltdown.
You know, an exodus of money, leaving equities there, leaving currencies there, flooding back into the funding currency, which is the U.S. dollar. And, you know, that's making problems in terms of your exports again. And, you know, so this whole cycle, you can't just get the good side without having the balanced side. That's part of the world. That's part of nature, you know, yin and yang, balance in nature, in financial markets as well. So the more that you try and, you know, suppress or control one aspect of a financial market, the more you put a sort of a more extreme correction force coming on the other side of it. And that's why I think they've front loaded all this stuff to make it look good. Lots of lipstick. But ultimately, they've undermined the strength and stability for the next few years. And so that's why I remain confident. And I know, it's been painstakingly, you know, frustrating to watch unsustainable behaviors and habits go on for so long, to watch the weakest, most, you know, unreliable, untrustworthy people, you know, recommending things and looking like they're genius. That's always hard, that late in any cycle. But when the rubber hits the road, as I say, the test comes in the next bear market, and it will be only then that we'll be able to measure who ended up where. Because bear cycles, like the one that began in 2000 from that highest ever valuations, 17 to 20 years, typically three market cycles, you know, expansion, contract. And when we get the third contraction here, that's when we're going to really know where we're actually, you know, where we actually finished up in this race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, inevitably, the music stops, and then whoever doesn't have a chair is kind of out of the game. You got to wonder, like, what type of bankruptcies we'll see, what type of liquidations, acquisitions, forced acquisitions, shotgun weddings a la the Fed, right? I mean, yeah. It's pretty remarkable when you think about it that we could be in this situation.
Well, it's just very classic. It's classic. The only thing that's different this time is they fabricated more zeros than had ever been fabricated before. But if you take words of wisdom from, you know, people back to the Bitcoin fiasco, you know, the quote of the week has to be, I got too caught up in the fear of missing out and trying to make a quick buck. The losses have pretty much left me financially ruined, said this one person that was quoted. And I thought, you know, that everyone can look at that. The people that weren't involved in Bitcoin may look at that and go, yeah, well, of course, you're silly. You know, that was a speculative episode. But I don't think that the people who are participating in broader markets today appreciate the extent to which they too have been sucked into this speculative frenzy, the financialization of the overall economy, the obsession with trying to make higher rates because rates were kept low, higher returns, I mean, because rates were low. And people have really, talked themselves into this idea that these reckless activities, regardless of valuation, who cares about valuation, has been the common theme. You know, it's going up, momentum, get in, all that. I don't think they appreciate the price that's coming for that type of behavior, and has always come for that type of behavior.
Hey, no doubt, we're in for some interesting times. No two ways about it. Hey, just a word about Tesla. Looks like Musk is having his difficulties. You really think that he can get the cash together to take that thing private?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of people in the world that understand the genius of his technology, and they understand that his ideas have already changed the world. There's a whole cult of people who love to hate, not just Elon Musk, but anybody that's really significantly challenging the status quo, is often a beacon for derision and people, you know, saying, I don't know, I don't understand it myself, why people hate people that challenge the status quo so much, but that's common. So I think he's had a really hard go. We all make mistakes. I think he's made quite a few lately. I think they've come from, you know, sleep deprivation, taking on more than you probably should, than anyone human is capable of doing. The man has five children on top of running all these companies and all these things.
Well, so something's got to give here.
As Adriana Huffington was telling him to have some sleep, I think that's a good idea. Probably get some more help. That's another good idea. But I think, you know, if anyone can pull off the apparently impossible, I would put money on Elon Musk for doing that. He has done it already. Let's face it. He has, you know, revolutionized the car industry, the way that we think about energy and transportation, the way we think about storing energy. And that's not even to get into his recycling of rocket batteries
SpaceX,
and all that stuff.
SpaceX is really the biggest, because it's so hard to make stuff for space because you just don't know. It's like worse. Picture yourself owning a boat. All right. You always wanted to own that boat. The two best days of a boat owner's life, the day they buy it, the day they sell it. When you got a boat, something always breaks on it. I don't care how good that boat is, who made it. You're always got stuff breaking.
Actually, when you have anything, yeah. Let's face it. I think this is the revelation this is the revelation of our age, isn't it? That we have too much stuff and it plagues us because it needs constant maintenance and the repair and updating. It's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So I think this is probably both a function of age as one gets on and says, I don't have a lot of time left. I don't want to waste all of it looking after my things. And also I think a function of a big consumption boom where everybody loaded up on more consumable breakable objects than ever before in history. Mm. So I think all of that's true, but I do hope the best for Mr. Musk. I think he is a genius and I think that he is only a human. And I do think that he's very passionate about what he's trying to do. And I see a great integrity and buy-in in what he does. As I said, he's not, there to just be a wealthy dude, obviously, because he would go off and be a wealthy dude if that's what he was really focused on. He's really focused on trying to change the world. And having said that, I also am very worried about the debt of the company because, as I say, his stock was part of this whole the equity that he was able to raise in the past few years has been also flying high on these waves of QE expansion, low rates, investor speculative appetite, all that stuff, as well as the debt he's been able to float. And if you're getting into another financial crisis, it hit his new company who was just starting out in 2008 badly. And I think it could hit it very badly again today. I think going private would help focus his attention where he wants to make it, which is on the longer term investment, innovation, development. There's a lot of people who are coming up with ideas about cutting, even Mr. Trump, wasn't it, this week tweeted something about cutting the quarterly, or he wants the investigation into whether we should have quarterly earnings reports. I think there's no question we shouldn't have quarterly earnings reports. I mean, it's investing. It's not supposed to be a casino or a scratch ticket. You're supposed to wait to see what the outcome of these long-term strategy and investment and development, all that. It takes time, right? So the whole obsession with extraction culture, which we've talked before, this has been really since the 1980s that this has got much worse. I think pendulum swing back. I think investors are going to have to stop thinking of it as their personal piggy bank to extract money out of companies and start realizing that investing by its very nature means leaving capital in the business longer term, focus and developing truly innovative stuff. So I think all that is where we're headed in the next while. And all that would be of service or of alignment with Mr. Musk's approach or where he'd like to be, let's put it that way, rather than having quarterly earnings calls. So we'll see. I wish him the best. I really do.
Absolutely. Same here. I mean, there's problems there. There's problems with the build quality on the Model 3. The one thing is he's a visionary, but up until he started these companies, he had no manufacturing expertise whatsoever, which is a plus and a minus. Plus is that he's not locked into the existing paradigm, but the minus is he didn't have experience putting out 300,000 copies of the same product. It's not easy, and there's a reason why there's only 10 major car companies left, give or take, why even the car companies you think are independent are really part of larger companies. It's been that trend since the Great Depression, and Tesla could easily become a casualty of that. We'll have to see what happens. Certainly, his accomplishments are groundbreaking, earth-shattering technology like it was never experienced in the auto industry. Their big deal for technology was, we have adaptive cruise control that'll slow down and speed up with the car in front of you. And that was a big deal. And still, they don't have it on every car. It's on every Tesla, but much goes way beyond that. Anyway, find Danielle's work over at jugglingdynamite.com and write us an email. I know Danielle's one of your favorites out there. I get emails all the time, so we'd love to get it, and we'll read some on the air next time. So financialsurvivalnetwork.com, the email address is kl@carrylutz.com. Danielle, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network.
It's all about what's next.